Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Now, 43 years after the 1980 release of this historical epic, Caligula, producer and reconstructionist Thomas Dagovin has realized the creator's original vision with Caligula, the ultimate cut, a version comprised of entirely never-before-seen footage shot in 1976. It is the story of Rome. It is the story of Caesar and the society and so much more. There's so much here. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that in addition to Malcolm McDowell, who plays the lead Caligula, also in the film is Peter O'Toole, Helen Mirren, Sir John Gielgud, and so much more. There's a lot to talk about here. We're joined today by the, as I said, producer and reconstructionist of Caligula, The Ultimate Cut, and that would be Thomas Dagovin. Thomas, welcome to Film School Radio.
Mike, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for this. I never saw this film back in the when it came out. There was obviously a tremendous amount of controversy and tumult, if you will, over the release of it. The taboo is too strong a word, but it's been one of those things that people do talk about occasionally when they talk about films, lost films, etc. How did you come to this project? What was your entry point into being involved in this particular project?
Penthouse had changed hands a few times since Bob Guccione's day.
Yeah.
And the new owners were looking at this storage facility that was filled with these old dusty boxes, and they called me in to come look at it and asked, is there something that could be done with this? And I was a huge Malcolm McDowell fan, but I had never seen Caligula because I heard from his mouth himself what a terrible movie it was. But I'd also heard him say he can't be responsible for what was released, but that he knows that they made a good movie. My curiosity was extremely piqued in knowing what was in those boxes. Like, was Malcolm correct? Was there a completely different film that had been made that the world never got to see?
So where do you start? So you've talked to the new owners of the rights to the actual rights to the film. At what point did you realize what that entailed? In other words, according to the material, there's 90 hours of footage shot. There's so much about the sort of reconstruction part of this, putting aside the film production itself, the initial one. But when did you realize what you had? Where were you when you realized this?
There are kind of different points. I mean, I knew that it was going to be fascinating at the very least. I knew that it was going to be a curiosity. I thought that we were going to release a film that had a few extended scenes cobbled together from things that maybe didn't cut together well and some audio sources that were not great. And I thought we'd have to put a big disclaimer at the front, basically asking for the audience's forgiveness because it was going to be a mess. The technology with audio had developed so much that we were able to rescue performances that we wouldn't have been able to 5 years ago. There were entire reels of negative that had come out of the camera in 1976 and been wrapped up, put into a can, and never looked at. And so what we started to discover is that we did, in fact, have enough to make a real movie of it. And there was a point where the editor and I, the editor Aaron Schaps, has been my partner in crime on all of this. And he and I had a moment that I refer to it as being like the moment when people are on a date and they're going to say they love each other or something, where I said, I have something I want to say, but I feel really weird about it. And he said, are you going to tell me that you think this is a good movie? And I said, yeah, I am. He said, I think it's going to be a great movie. I said, I think it's going to be a great movie. And we were laughing at each other. We had found so much that was good and was so different than what we expected, in the sense of we were able to take Helen Mirren's arc from 9 minutes of a two-dimensional character to almost an hour where she supports the entire third act of the story. And Malcolm, I found out later, was kind of not being directed on set. So his performances, he was doing lots of different approaches. And that there was an approach that we were able to build a narrative with that was extraordinarily powerful. And so the histrionics of the 1980 version are gone. Like there was a legitimately serious, it's a very dark comedy. Like people will be surprised. Like there's a lot of things in there that are meant to get laughs. Like there's a lot within Citatus, like him being made consul and, you know, things like that. There's a lot of things that if the audience doesn't laugh out loud, we miss the mark. And so I think people will be surprised that it's a very dramatic, very powerful film. It's very dark and very humorous. And yeah, and so and it turned out that we didn't have to put any kind of disclaimer on the front. It completely functions as a movie, even if you'd never heard of the 1980 version.
I can only imagine the amount of time and effort and diligence to go through all of this. And one of the things I read was that a lot of the film was shot with three cameras basically side by side. Do I have that correct? So that you were getting a lot of other angles. So I can only imagine going through this and trying to find those elements that gave Malcolm McDowell's character a consistent arc. I can't imagine how hard that must have been for you.
And we started in 2019.
Yeah, I believe it.
Give people an idea of the distance between buying the groceries at the store and when the cake is being served. It did take a long time. I'm extraordinarily grateful to the investors that they were as patient as they were. My target was wanting this to be something you didn't make any excuses for. And being invited to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival was the best redemption for this film that I could have hoped for. And that wouldn't have been possible if I didn't have the lenience and the liberty to have taken the time to do this right.
I just want to quickly remind our listeners, we're speaking with a producer and reconstructionist of this re-release of Caligula. It's called Caligula, The Ultimate Cut. Let's talk about the director. Tinto Brass, am I saying that correct?
Yeah, Tinto. Depending on your country of origin, you'll pronounce it differently. But Tinto Brass is how...
Brass, okay. How did Bob Guccione... What was the inspiration for this? And what went into the decision to bring Tinto into this project? Like, putting together the original team. And if you, as a follow-on, at what point did Tinto realize that he had lost control of the project? And what was that sort of... What was the mindset of Bob Guccione in all of this?
The movie originated with Franco Rossellini, the nephew of the great director Roberto Rossellini. Not getting into his history, stepping right to Gore, he approached Gore with a treatment that his uncle had written that didn't get off the ground. And Gore said, "I don't want to see your uncle's treatment, but I would love to do a Caligula." So he wrote a script titled Gore Vidal's Caligula, which was the original name of the film. And they got Paul Morrissey as a director from the Andy Warhol camp and were talking to Mick Jagger to be the lead and could not get funding. And then a producer named Jack Silverman, who had recently been hired by Bob Guccione to head up a new Penthouse Films organization, was a tenant in a building that Gore Vidal owned in New York. And they ran into each other, and Gore and Bob had been friendly. Jack Silverman just basically, you know, in an elevator kind of conversation, "Oh, what have you been up to, Gore?" "Oh, I'm trying to get this Caligula film off the ground." And Jack thought, well, this is something Bob would love. He brought Gore and Franco Rossellini into Bob. Bob had invested in movies like The Longest Yard in Chinatown, and he wanted to be in control of something. And he thought, Caligula is perfect to do the mesh of sex and art that I want to do. What a great subject. Let's do the movie. So he then came on board as an investor, and he said, well, the first thing you got to do is get rid of that weirdo. He didn't want to be involved with like the artsy New York crowd. He wanted someone that he thought shared his vision of a more classical, traditional sexuality. Not sure why he thought that was Tinto Brass, but the most that I can glean from it is that he knew that Tinto wouldn't flinch at the kind of sex that he wanted in the film. And also that he thought that Tinto was controllable and would kind of succumb to his strong producer hand. That was absolutely not the case. And the first thing that Malcolm remembers Tinto saying to him on set is, if we don't screw these Americans, we fail. And so Tinto was an anarchist that did not like Bob Guccione. And so they were at each other's throats from day one. And Tinto would hire people that were missing teeth, and he would go out on the streets and hire ex-cons and prostitutes to be extras on the set. And Bob referred to that as, well, that's Tinto's idea of a little joke. And then to combat that, he flew in a bunch of penthouse pets and ordered that they were put front and center. So by all accounts, the set was just a battlefield between all of these people that hated each other. And left adrift in that chaos were the performers, were the actors. And so the thing that we really tried to do was I tried to come in as an arbitrator and think, well, who's defending not just the performers, but the film they're making? Like, everybody was more concerned about fighting. Everyone was more concerned about what someone else was doing and those kind of combat situations. And so I have no idea where I am in relation to your question.
No, that this is great. This is what I just I'm curious because
that's where we
is,
are.
You know, right. This is one of the, I'm just going to make an observation. I don't know if it's true or not true, but it just feels like so often the film that is being made and the production that is behind that often end up reflecting one another. In the kind of chaos that was the depravity of Rome, you find this sort of chaos. I don't know if depravity is the right word to describe the behind the scenes, but it sort of mirrors kind of that sort of hand-to-hand combat where whoever's in charge makes all the decisions, right? Yeah. And
well, that's ultimately why Bob won, because he had the purse strings and the lawyers. And I want to answer a thing you said to me before we started recording. Like, you said, how true is this movie? How accurate?
Yes.
And so one of the things about that is that the reality was far worse. When I started reading Suetonius and the original sources, which of course were written after Caligula's time and were hit pieces because it was by people after him. But the legends of what he did were more horrific than what's in the film.
Wow.
But when you, one of the challenges with this movie is, like, Bob Guccione kept saying, this is going to be the most accurate film about Rome ever created. Meanwhile, the set designer is building a three-story decapitation machine. And on this other set, he's putting an elevator. And it's like, how can you say this with a straight face? And so the thing that opened it up for me was I started looking at it almost like a 1970s comic European graphic novel or a modern opera. Yes. And then when I started looking at it like that, I realized this is the truest version of the story because it plays like a fable.
Yes.
And much like The Little Prince, a story doesn't have to have happened to be true. Like, is it a true story? So the idea of all of these things about innocence and the corrupting influence of power and the lack of discipline, and but even more than that, the idea of a character in a story recognizing that he's a character and transcending into legend becomes more real in the way that we react not only to history, but to our own lives. You know, if you think about as you age, how you start to recognize our transient nature and the fact that the things in the beginning that Tiberius was saying to him proved to be true and that it is just a cycle. It's a movie that if you watch it the second time, I guarantee you'll pick up more, and the third time even more. And I think the most important thing I just really would want everyone to know is that it doesn't matter what your perception is of the old movie. This is, it's not even in the same universe.
Right.
I mean, the fact that Malcolm said, I would never go near this movie. Like it was a huge, huge betrayal for him. And the fact that he has been so vocal and supportive and passionate about this one should be an indicator that it's a completely different world.
And as the title would imply, it is about Caligula. It is about, and it's, so it's all about the performance. And there is, I love that description. It is a, it's a, it's grand opera. It is a sweeping, yes, just what you said. I couldn't agree more. It is all of that. And the fact that it, Peter O'Toole, Sir John Gielgud, Helen Mirren in this film, and their performances are, I can't help but feel that they didn't get the opportunity to expand the kind of the broad outlines of the character. But when they're on screen, I'm a huge Peter O'Toole fan. And I just, every time I see him, no matter what, I just feel very compelled by his presence and his ability to bring whatever it is he brings to his performances. I find him to be one of the best actors that I've ever seen. And so I just want to get that out there, that this, yes, just what you said is a very, very appropriate description of the film.
Peter and Tinto hated each other. And in the final moments before filming, it was just Peter's role was getting cut more and more and more as they entered production. And he had a meeting with Tinto. And in his journals, he talks about this. He said that he was talking about the depth and breadth he wanted to try to bring to it. And the way he described what they wanted is he said, well, Father Christmas is what they want. Father Christmas is what they'll get. And he just kind of lamented, they just want me to play this role this way. And I'm here for the paycheck, so I'll do it. But I feel like with Nerva and Tiberius, with John Gielgud and Peter O'Toole, it's such a gift just to see them at all. I think that with Malcolm and Helen, you get so much more. And I think Malcolm particularly is at the height of his powers at this point, because if you think about what the arc of film was, or the arc of the films that he did leading into this.
Is that Clockwork Orange? Was Clockwork Orange before or after?
Before, but If, which a lot of Americans don't know, but everybody should see If.
Yes, yes.
Clockwork Orange. Oh, Lucky Man, which is a bizarre film, but another one that everyone should see, that he and Helen were in that together. But so you're coming off of this, that run of Lindsay Anderson films that, just even as a curiosity, even if you don't love the Caligula film, you can't deny that it's unquestionably one of his best performances. And the fact that the world didn't get to see it, think of how painful that must be as a performer. To spend a year of your life delivering this incredible performance, and then you go see it and it's completely hacked to bits and it's made into a joke. And so if nothing else, anyone who's a fan of good cinema or Malcolm McDowell, I hope you'll watch it just for his incredible performance.
He is so locked in, and it does feel like he is running as fast as he can in his performance. Like he is there hoping that whatever energy he brings to this performance, he can drag everyone else along with him. That's how it felt to me watching him.
Yeah, one thing that he said to me was that the sets were so big.
Yes.
And he wasn't getting any direction from Tinto. That he was talking with the script supervisor, kind of like, what do I do? And the thing that he was doing is he felt like so many of the Italian actors didn't speak English. He felt that he had to lock in so hard to his character and play it to that set and really inhabit it. And I think it's a testament to his skill. It feels very, it's very Shakespearean, but you know, he's a cinema actor. So one scene that really gets me is when he's in the room with Nerva, and Nerva is in the bath, and you're looking at just the subtle expressions on the face of Caligula. He knew when to play it big, and he knew when to play it really subtle. And It's an outstanding performance. That's the thing I'm most excited about with it hitting theaters.
Yeah.
It's just that people are going to get to see this. It's like a lost album by one of the great bands, like a lost Beatles album or something.
Going back to Peter O'Toole for a minute, that run of Lawrence of Arabia was prior, you know, many years before, I don't know, many, but few years before, but this was right around the time of the Stuntman, I believe. And I feel like he was channeling one way or the other. I'm not sure which came first, in the Stuntman or in Caligula, but there was a lot of that character, that sort of that, there's a famous line for me anyway, in the Stuntman, where he said, if God could do the things we could do, he'd be a happy man. He was describing his role as a director, right? If God could do the things we can do, he'd be a happy man. And I felt like that's what he was bringing to that performance of in this film. I'm wandering off the path here a little bit, but I was
listening to you laughing, thinking if you and I start talking about Peter O'Toole, we're going to need another 3 hours, because I'm a huge, huge Peter O'Toole fan.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just love him. There's like 3 hours of footage of him just swimming in that pool with like the robe swirling around him. And I'm not going to lie, I watched it multiple times. Like, that's how big a fan I am. I'm like, I'm going to watch this man swim.
Yeah.
He's such a character, and completely high the entire filming, because the doctors wouldn't let him drink or he would die. And so everybody's talked about this, that he was, because he couldn't drink anymore, so he was just stoned the whole time.
Okay. And, well, he definitely was channeling some rage.
I don't mean that that's what makes the performance is good. I just mean that in the sense of like, he's such a larger than life character, was my point. That, and I should clarify this just so it doesn't sound like it's just drug glorification. What I meant was such a miserable, miserable set. And they told him, just play it really two-dimensional. And the fact that, you know, kind of like someone that was a notorious boozer as he was, that he was like, well, I'm just going to get through it. And the fact that he did that and still delivered a performance that is unnerving to me. There's points where he's looking at the camera that it doesn't matter how jovial I know he is once that stops. As an Emperor Tiberius, he's terrifying. I think he's magnificent. So I realized I was not explaining really why I was mentioning that. I think that's just, to me, is the fact that he could turn it on like that was just, I'm just a fan. I think he's such a brilliant performer.
And for me, that ability in the dialogue to be so brazenly honest with people in the room, to be talking about them, is a demonstration of the ultimate power that the emperors possessed. They could say and do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted to do it. And I thought he and Malcolm McDowell embodied that ethos, you know, about as well as you possibly could.
Well, it's interesting in the beginning that Malcolm is the innocent and we're looking at the depravity of the emperor. And then by the end of the film, everything that he detested had come to pass in his own life, but he recognizes it as Tiberius did. Tiberius in the beginning says, in my old age, I've become a swineherd. And there's just all of these you know, disdain that he had for people. And you see that develop in Caligula. It's a cyclical story. That's why it really does benefit. It does benefit a second watch.
Yeah, it does. I did. I watched it twice. So
okay.
I can attest. Where and how can people see Caligula, the Ultimate Cut?
I believe that there's a theater listing on the Draft House website. Also, it's going to be available on, I'm showing my age when I say pay-per-view, but I think it's VOD. You'll be able to buy it online the same time it's in theaters. So I recommend seeing it on the big screen for sure. But if you're in a town where it's not playing, you'll still get to see it.
My congratulations to you, because this was a labor of love. I don't know, at various points during the whole journey that you had with this film, you must have doubted your sanity at least a couple of times in all of this. So I appreciate that you've kept going.
I would tell my family every day after breakfast, I would say, all right, I'm headed off to ancient Rome. And it was so immersive It was, you know, 96 hours of footage. When you're watching that over and over and over again, it was to the point where when the movie was done, I forgot what was in the movie, because in my head, I know all these other shots and all these other things. And so once I was away from it for a little bit and I watched it again, it was kind of a different experience, because I had been so immersed in, it was funny talking to Malcolm McDowell and knowing things. I had talked to someone else involved with the film, and, you know, I was kind of trying to really gently correct them. And it was only just because I'd been so in the production and in the production notes and the interviews of the day. And so it is a unique experience to be that submerged in something for so many years.
I mean this. I truly admire your dedication to doing this, because once you dive into the history and all of the stuff with the Guccione and all of the other things that went along with this kind of madness, that what you've done here is, I agree. I think people will watch this film. I would say, just as you described it, the focus on Malcolm McDowell and his performance and the others who are here, as we mentioned, Helen Mirren, and there's a lot here. And I love that you said, which I was very curious about, that is this an accurate reflection of this period of time in Roman history? And I'm glad to hear what you said. And the people who have listened to the conversation already know what you said. And I just, there's so much to admire here. And I want to thank you for all of it.
I sincerely appreciate it. It's another exciting part about it coming out into the world, is that I'm not alone with it anymore. It's like having this incredible, like the Mona Lisa or something, in your apartment, and you finally, you know, get to take it and hang it up in the museum. I'm really, really proud of the movie. I had a great team, and I'm really, I'm happy. I feel like it's a huge victory for art that these performances are going to get to be seen.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful fable, and it is a true story that I think is not going to go out of any style. I think 50 years from now, it's going to hold up, because it is a true story about power and our relationship with reality, really.
We've been speaking with the producer and reconstructionist of Caligula, The Ultimate Cut, Thomas Ngoven. Thomas, again, thank you so very much for your time today.
Thank you very, very much. I enjoyed this so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.